So actually, it's not gambling. It's actually worse than gambling. Because at
Okay.
least gambling, you know all of the risks. You know all of the factors. Like if you're playing blackjack, you know there are 52 cards on the deck, and you know exactly, you can start to do math on what the likelihood of all these things happened. It's in a finite window of calculation, right? You can't do that for VC. Hi, I'm Nicole Glaros, and you're listening to Gut Talks. Double G-U, double T.
Hi everyone, I'm Maria and welcome to Gut Talks, a podcast brought to you by Gut, WGUTT.com. I enjoy adding value and helping wherever I can, widening my spectrum of thoughts, even if it can sometimes challenge the mainstream. This is why we give data a voice and co-create a collective intelligence involving both people who are not always in the limelight and those who are, in order to learn from each other and spread knowledge, creative and critical thinking. To date, we've had guests from over 35 countries and counting. All I ask is to rate the show, leave a review, and share it. Now let's get started. Nicole Glaros is an entrepreneur, operator, and executive, venture capitalist, and investor. She wears multiple hats and is also a board director, teacher, and speaker. I came across Nicole when I enrolled in the Venture Deals course by Techstars. She got me engaged, and I reached out after reading several of her blog posts, which I highly recommend. We explore crucial topics like the right timing for approaching VCs and investing in funds, common reasons founders struggle to raise funds, product market fit, and how she got started in the entrepreneurial space, and more, such as hairstyling. Here we go.
Nicole, the way I actually got to know about you is when I took the Venture Deals course, and I just like what you were saying and the way you presented things and the way you gave like kind of constructive information about like how to do stuff. I'm not in any way raising money or planning to be an investor at this moment, but I just thought I would like to have a chat with you. And I reached out and here we are. So thank you so much for this.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed that. You know, it's funny, I haven't actually watched the thing all the way through. I need to do that. I've watched sections of it, but not the whole thing. But I have been close with Foundry Group and Brad Feld, the team on Venture Deals, for a very long time. And they're the ones that really taught me how to invest. And so it's an honor actually to participate in the continuing education and giving back to the next generation of investors. And so I was really, well, first of all, I was really honored to take that role. And I'm also really flattered to hear the feedback from people who take it that said that it was very powerful for them and very helpful. So I'm glad that we got connected in that way.
Yeah, I work with founders and it's always good to hear different perspectives, because one thing also, like in the US sometimes, like, or often the perspective can be different than Europe. So it's always good to hear how you do things other than you just read them. Or, and I like the way you presented things. And so I'm really excited for this one. And I read some of your posts because you have a blog and there's lots of takeaways. But one of them was about your gray hair when it was COVID and so on. But you actually look like much younger, you know, because when you associate gray hair, what made you actually do that? Gray? Because it suits you. I like it. I like it because you have different tonalities as well. So
yeah, I do.
I'm watching.
It's like silver and gray and, and I mean, I don't know how to, like, there are so many answers to that question. Why? It really stemmed from COVID and that I couldn't get to the salon. And I tried to dye it myself a couple times and ended up with these big gaps. Like, it looked terrible. And so I thought, what would happen if I just let it grow out? And I didn't realize how gray I was until I started to let it grow out, because I had been dyeing it for so long. And as it was coming in, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm really gray. So it started just out of COVID. Really. And then it sort of stayed that way because I got lazy. Like, dyeing your hair is expensive and it's chemicals that you're just, these nasty chemicals that you're putting on your body all the time. And for me, my hair grows very quickly. So it would be 2 weeks before you could start to see the demarcation line. So like dyeing my hair every 2 or 3 weeks was just destroying it. And so anyway, laziness and then health reasons, like I just didn't like the chemicals that I was putting on. And then I started to get mad a little bit. I was like, why? I know a lot of, almost every woman I know from the age of 32 and up dyes her hair. Why? Because we don't like doing it. We might like how it looks, But I don't know a single woman that actually enjoys the process of going and spending 2 hours at the salon and paying $200. And I was like, why? Oh, because like there's a culture and an industry that tells us that gray hair is old and unattractive. And I got angry. And so I thought, well, not that I'm going to ever single-handedly, I'm not a Hollywood celebrity. I don't have millions and millions of followers. So like, I'm not going to change the trends, right? But at least I can contribute to not continuing the trend. And so I kept it. And it ended up being a really fun social experiment too. Like the reactions that I would get from people was really interesting. And it said more about them than it did about me. But, you know, to this day, I still get very mixed reactions. So some people are like, what are you doing?
Really?
You need to buy that. And other people are like, you look beautiful. And who knows if everyone's saying the truth. Like the society is trying to tell women that they look beautiful. But I want to be who I am inside and out all the way through. And I want to show that you can be beautiful all the way your authentic self. And I want to set that example for my kids. And I want to set an example for the next generation of women that are coming up. And I want to save myself 2 hours and $200 every other week. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons, right? Like the only reason I can think of to diet is because someone out there says that gray is old. And I am older. I'm okay with that. It comes with a lot of benefits. I'm not trying to be 20. So I don't know. It's a little bit of my middle finger to what society says on the topic of beauty and me just trying to step into who I am.
Yeah. The thing is, I wasn't really planning to ask you this question or anything like that, but I saw that you made a post about it, right, on your blog. And I was like, okay. And as I'm just talking to you now, as we're starting to record this episode, I need to ask you this question because I'll tell you what, I saw this picture and I saw a picture of you with hair dyed. And it's how I saw you the first time, right? When I was listening.
Hair.
Yeah. And that's you for me, right? And that's how I associate, you know, it's just a visual memory, right? How you remember people. And that's how I remember you. But I always used to say also that whenever the time comes for me to dye my hair, I don't want to dye my hair because I don't want to spend 2 hours either every other week. I have a few gray hairs. I do highlights, but that's it at the moment. But I know at some point it's going to come quite soon. I think the transition will be difficult. So I like that.
The transition was hard because I didn't dye it. So there was this very clear, like demarcation line that just kind of grew out slowly. I was lucky enough that it was during COVID. So you can see I tend to wear my hair up. And so people couldn't always tell for a long time. And so what happened was, is like, we all were in person all the time and I had brown hair and then COVID happened. And then when I started seeing people again, I had gray hair. They're like, what just happened? So for most people that I worked with and knew and loved, they were very shocked by it. So it's only been, the last time I dyed my hair was in January of 2020.
Okay.
So it's been 4 years now.
Yeah. Cool. I like, this is an introduction. I know most of the listeners here are men, but it's okay. Now I think that's good because not everyone might know what women go through when it's about dyeing their hair. So
what I would tell your male population is your woman is probably dyeing her hair and she probably looks way better without it. And so love on her and encourage her to be her full self rather than dyeing it. And I promise you, she looks better without it.
Yeah,
so
that's great advertising for all the dyeing hair dyeing companies out there that have the products and hairdressers.
All the hairstylists out there are cursing me.
Yes, here we go. Well, an opportunity for a new startup in the space, right? Yes. So let's take it that way. That's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about, you're a founder turned investor. We're going to talk about founders' challenges, investing, about what to look for and stuff like that. But I want to start first. How did you realize you had an entrepreneurial mindset?
Well, it came from a couple places. So first of all, my dad's an entrepreneur. And so he started his own company. So my grandfather is an entrepreneur, my dad's dad. And then my dad was an entrepreneur, is an entrepreneur still, actually. He's 82 and he still runs his company. So just to give you an idea. I was accustomed to being around entrepreneurs and how they think. And then also I had this mother. I have a very independent thinking, strong-willed mom. I grew up with her in my ear saying, never rely on somebody else for your income. You want to always have your own money. And then my dad saying the only way to financial independence is running your own business. Right. And so I just had those two messages in my head a lot as a kid. I never really saw myself as an entrepreneur, although I was doing entrepreneurial things, but I never really considered that as even a career path. It wasn't until I was in college and I was looking at a mountain of student debt and trying to figure out this degree that I was in the process of getting that was not actually going to pay me that well. And I was going to spend the next two decades like paying off my student debt. And I was like, this just doesn't work. Like the economics don't work. How do I live? You know? And it was my dad who said, well, you should start a company. And I was like, okay, what would I do? And he actually was the one that came up with the idea for the first company. And I started it. And he was a big part of that, like advising and guiding and helping. And it worked. Like, who knew? And so that was literally like my first like foray into entrepreneurship was just a way to get out of student debt and figure out how to make ends meet, really. It wasn't like I had some big passion or some big idea or some like I wasn't going to work for anybody else. For me, it wasn't that. It was a means to an end. I got to get out of student debt. I need to fix my financial situation. And by the way, for anyone that's listening, that is a terrible reason to build a startup because you have like a 95% chance of failing. But I got lucky, right? I mean, we could spend an hour talking about the luck skill continuum, how much of our outcomes are due to luck versus how much of our outcomes are due to skill. And I can with confidence tell you that that first outcome for me was luck. It was not skill. I took one economics. I didn't take any business classes when I was in college. I took one economics class. I hated it, right? Ask me now about the Fed because now I sit on the board of an organization that employs the largest number of economists anywhere in the world. Anyway, I didn't know what I was doing, but I had my dad's help. And so that also instilled in me the sense of mentorship and giving back and helping people because I got help. I mean, yes, it was my father, but he didn't have to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And it made me part of who I am today. So I started, for what it's worth, I started two more companies after that. They were both miserable failures. I blew through all of the earnings off the sale of my first company. Granted, I wasn't in debt anymore, but I was broke and I needed a job for the first time in my life. For a real job, like not I'm waiting tables to make, you know, pay my rent when I was college job. And that was actually how I got on sort of the professional side of startups was because I found this organization that was in Colorado that worked with early stage founders. And my idea at the time was, wow, I really want to start another company, but I'm broke. I need a job. And I don't know what I did wrong. Like how do I learn to not make those same mistakes again? And I thought if I worked with this company for a while, I could save a little bit of money and I could learn what I got wrong so that the next startup would be successful. And I kind of never really left that side of the table. Like I've been on that side of the table ever since, although I'm doing a couple startups right now. So I'm a little bit back in the founder seat. But even my early days at Techstars, when I joined Techstars, it was mostly just David Cohen, who's the founder. So there are four founders, but the three of them were mostly just capital. They were there as input and support, but David Cohen was the one that was really feet on the ground, actually running the day-to-day of the business. It was really his company. And so when I started, it was mostly just David and I. We had a part-time bookkeeper. There was like a volunteer office community manager. There was like a few people hanging around, but it was just really him and I. And so I'm not a founder of Techstars, but I was sort of the first real person that stayed for a very long time. And when I started, it was David had invested in 10 companies and had gone through one accelerator program. And when I left, we had invested in over 3,000 portfolio companies, growing at 500 a year with 300 employees in 19 countries. So I'm this kind of weird blend of entrepreneur, scaling executive, operator, investor. I've raised a number of funds now, deployed a lot of capital, and also sports psychologist, because that was what my background was in. That was what I was doing when I decided I needed to start a company. So I come at investing in a very different way. I don't come at it from a finance background. I don't come at it from a business background, although those things are all really important. But those in my mind were all tactical, like learnable skills. And most of it I've learned, I still have weaknesses, right? So I still need the analysts around me to help me with, to make sure that an analyst takes them 10 minutes to put together a cap table. And for me, it takes me forever. I can do it, but I need somebody to make sure that my numbers are correct and look over my shoulder, right? But when you're in the early stages of a company, it's not about all that. It's about the team. It is about their strengths and their weaknesses and how well they know those things and how well they work together and how they handle conflict and how curious they are about the world and how well they execute. There is nothing on a spreadsheet that can show you that, not in the early days. And so I often say that my background in sports psych is my secret weapon because it taught me how to identify sort of the strengths and weaknesses in the individuals and in the team, and then try to figure out how to bring out their strengths and help them compensate for their weaknesses. And it's like, when I'm talking to founders, one of the things I always say is most founders are like this. They come in and they have to do everything well, right? I'm the CEO, I'm the founder, like I have to do all this. I have to be good at everything because I'm in charge. And the thing that I like to remind them is if you are good at everything, you are great at nothing. And we need to figure out what you are great at. And then by process of elimination, figure out what you're not great at so that we can then identify people who are great at those things. And that is how you build a great company, right? It's not by being good at everything. And that will just be the death of you because you're not good at everything. And your ceiling, the ceiling of the business is only the ceiling of how good you are. And you're lying to yourself, right? Someone else is going to come out and beat you because you're going to be great at, and you're going to only be good.
Ad break. No, that's not an ad. This podcast is brought to you by GUT, GUTT, which is the platform I launched to augment human capabilities focused on creativity, design, co-creation, and critical thinking. I would love to know more about you and your preferences to continue producing this kind of content. So type in go.gut.com/talks. It takes 60 seconds to complete. That's go.gutt.com/talks. Now let's get going.
How do you do that? How do you help them be aware of the fact that they're not good at many things, but they're great at a few things, let's say?
It's different with different founders, but I had to boil it down to one thing. It would just be creating trust between that founder and me to build a safe space where they can, or we can say, look, you're not good at this, and that's okay. They feel this social pressure, this career pressure. And when you relieve that pressure, they kind of exhale into it a little bit. Okay, God. Right? But if you stop putting that pressure on them and you make it okay, in fact, not only do you make it okay, but you make it better that they're not that way. And then they feel safe about talking about that stuff. And so sometimes, I mean, usually with a founder, you can identify pretty quickly what they're good at. And I would argue that any investor that has spent any time with founders can figure that out pretty fast, usually within a couple meetings, right? And then you just use process of elimination. And then you build trust and you talk about that with them. And so it's like, for me, I'm here to tell you that the finance side, I would just say the spreadsheet side of the business is what I am not great at. I'm okay at it. It's called the zone of competence, right? I'm competent, but some people are excellent or genius at it. And I want to be around those people. And so you surround yourself with people that are excellent or genius at those things. Man, it becomes like a flywheel, but right? And it's really that simple. I mean, it's simple, but it's not easy.
You mentioned love.
I read this wonderful book that I would highly recommend every single investor to read. And it's called Success Equation. And it is by a guy named Michael Mabuzin. And I think he was the CIO, the chief investment officer at Morgan Stanley. I think I might be wrong about that, but that's my recollection. Anyway, he actually has a mathematical formula for the influence of luck versus skill. And the challenge is that when it is over, when an outcome happens over a long period of time, that exposes it to more what I would just call environmental factors, right? Market swings, new competition coming into the market, macroeconomics, right? Microeconomics, your lead engineer dies. I don't know. Like, so over a longer period of time, luck plays an increasingly important role. So much so that it can eventually overtake. Skill has actually very little to do with it. So in the world of investing, specifically early stage investing, when you have you're holding positions for a decade or longer, it is mostly luck, mostly. But we can't raise capital. If you're an investor, you can't raise capital by telling a luck story. So we all fool ourselves into thinking that skill, look at how good we are at our jobs, because we have a couple of these markups on paper, right? Oh, the company's raised around, so therefore I'm good at what I do. And we have to remember that the true judge of our skill is cash on cash returns, which can often take a decade or longer to play out. But you can't raise a fund every decade. You got to do it every 3 years. So you're just telling a very different story. And as investors, we like to believe our own dreams. So I think knowing what a huge, like the reason I like that book is because it just really reminded me how important luck was in the equation and that I was fooling myself thinking I was good at it. And that's step one, is acknowledging it, right? And then step two is figuring out, well, how can you use that to your advantage? What can you do as an investor to understand that luck plays a huge role and that you need to maximize the chances that you're lucky, right? And when you start thinking about it like that way, you start thinking about deploying capital differently. And so a very real example of that is Techstars, because if you invest in 10 or even 30 companies, so the average venture capitalist has a portfolio, each fund will have a portfolio roughly of about 30. That's kind of the standard, right? 25, maybe 35, maybe a big one would be 40. The end there, the portfolio size is enough. You're still very, very, very much subject to luck. And when you have only these 3-year deployment cycles, you're still very much relying on luck because you're in a cycle, 3-year deployment cycle, that is not long enough to sort of counter the ups and the downs, ebbs and the flows of what the market, the macroeconomics are doing. And so you can start to think, okay, I can think about longer deployment cycles, or I can think about higher portfolio counts, much higher portfolio counts. So Techstars, we had raised a fund. I should say the last fund that I raised before I left, I say it will have probably 800 positions in it. And so what that means is that you're kind of cutting off the top performance layer. Like if you have a company that 3,000 X's, right? The hit of that will be lower because it's got to offset all these losses. But also the loss ratio, it also doesn't lose money. Like with a very, very, very high degree of predictability, you can return capital because your portfolio size is of a certain, is big enough that it can sort of weather these like the math. And so that was how we chose to maximize luck. And part of that was like the genius of Jason Seeds, who was my partner at Techstars. And was the chief investment officer there for a long time. And then me figuring out how to like actually execute against that. And so, but even as an individual investor, you start thinking a lot about that. Like, how do I maximize my likelihood of taking advantage of luck? And, you know, some of that is learning to not, it depends on what kind of fund you are. If you're an individual investor, you can learn to not deploy capital crazy hot cycles like 2022. You're going to not maximize luck by doing that, right? You're actually maximizing. Actually, that's not true. You're maximizing luck. It's just bad luck. And you can learn to invest heavily in down cycles, which is kind of going on right now. So those investors that I know that are flushing cash, that are prescient in their deployment of capital, are investing a lot right now because there are a lot of deals to be had out there. And so that's the increasing of likelihood of good luck. So anyway, I think understanding that as a concept, if you just understand that as a concept, you can start to behave differently and you start to invest differently, and you can increase your chances of luck rather than increase your chances of bad luck.
You know, Keith Steer said VC is gambling. So what's your take on that?
It's not wrong.
Yeah.
So actually, it's not gambling. It's actually worse than gambling. Because at least gambling, you know all of the risk. You know all of the factors. Like if you're playing blackjack, you know, there are 52 cards on the deck and you know exactly, you can start to do math on what the likelihood of all these things happen. It's in a finite window of calculation, right? You can't do that for VC because it's an infinite potential of outcome. Infinite. Yeah. So it's a little bit worse than gambling because you don't know all the odds. You just don't. And so that's why you absolutely need to maximize your luck, your chances of luck. And I mean, by the way, one of the things that we do as VCs is we screen. So you have an investment committee that's making investment decisions, which company you're going to invest in. That in itself is a step towards increasing luck, right? If you just like threw all your money out there and prayed, I'm not sure how well that would work. But if you did it enough times, it actually would work very well because you would capture the winners and you would capture the losers. So it just depends on the number of positions that you're investing in. So it's like again, we can't raise capital when we just go around and say, like, well, I'm not actually very good at this. It's really luck that no investor, no LP will give you money if you do that. So you have to show them all of the ways that you are increasing your likelihood of returning capital. And that's usually your pipeline and your network and your expertise in certain areas and your deal flow and how your investment committee works and how your partnership works and the lack of risk there. And there's all these things that the LPs want to look for to say, how are you reducing the likelihood of bad luck? Although they don't use that language. They just call it risk. Same thing.
What is it, if I may ask, what is it that made you leave Techstars? It sounded like you had a fantastic time actually there.
It was a hard decision. It was a really, and it had been sitting with me for actually many years before I pulled the trigger on it. The truth is, I'm a startup person. I'm a generalist. I like to wear lots of hats and chew on really gnarly problems, especially ones that I don't know anything about, that I don't have any experience with, right? I like to have my hands at all of it because it's more fun for me that way. And as a company grows, it really doesn't need generalists anymore. It needs specialists. It needs people that are experts in a specific area. That needs to be their zone of genius. So two things. Number one, I like to move fast and break things, and I'm always wanting to reinvent, and I'm always wanting to recreate. And when you get to a certain size, that's hard to do, right? And so I was always feeling like I couldn't, like my inner creativity couldn't manifest because it was always very disruptive to the company. And the second thing is, the things that I was working on, there were people out there that like were experts or geniuses at these things, and I clearly wasn't, right? And it was just time. Like, I wanted to get back to building. I wanted to get back to creating. Wanted to get back to having my hands in all these different things and being boots on the ground. And I don't like staying in my lane, but that's what Techstars needed. And so part of the departure was really an act of love. It was like the best thing for Techstars. And I wanted Techstars to succeed more than anything. And sometimes that means stepping out.
And question, since you like starting, building, creating, right? Making things happen. In terms of investing, do you go more for like early stage because you want to be hands-on or later stage? What kind of investor are you?
Yeah. Well, for a while there, I was only investing, just because of my role at Techstars, I was only really investing in funds. I couldn't do any investing anymore. Now, I have done a few direct investments, but I'm finding that I don't like doing it anymore because it's sort of the same thing as a VC where you meet a company a couple times, you kind of make a judgment call, and then you write a check and you pray. And I feel like that's not good. It's not good for me. It doesn't increase my likelihood of capturing luck. I mean, it's actually not good for the company. And I know there's all these founders out there that are cringing when I say this, right? But there are so many companies out there that should not be raising. And it's gotten so like popular. It's gotten so in vogue to go raise a round. Like I started a company and I raised money, and that's like that normal path for everyone. And the truth is, it shouldn't be. There is a very small percentage of companies that venture capital is appropriate for. But the VC community glorified it, and it became this like badge of honor for these companies to raise. And so I actually think most of them are much better served not raising, or at least not raising early, raising a little bit later when the business is worked out. And so right now, one of the things I'm working on is that concept, is on more like, how do we help the companies? How do we really help them figure out the business and the unit economics before they ever even raise capital? How do we help them keep their day jobs so that they can really build out the business case for the business before raising? And if you can do that well, then the companies will skyrocket with very little capital at risk and very little founder time and life risk. What I mean by that is these founders, they go out and raise these rounds and they spend 3, 4, 5 years of their life on something that was never going to work in the first place. And that's just, to me, it's not only heartbreaking to watch them spend that long of their life on something to end in failure that wasn't going to work in the first place that we could have figured out. And it's also doubly bad because it's burning investor capital on something that wasn't going to work, right? It means it's not good for jobs. It's literally not good for anyone. So anyway, I think a lot about that now, and how do we help these companies sort of put pressure on the lead drivers of performance, both individual performance and company performance, to try to help them get to a place where raising capital does make sense, but also that they can raise less capital, that they can figure out the unit economics of the business much quicker. So I spent a lot of time thinking about that.
So that's what you're working on at the moment, right? And is this for like founders with an idea, just an idea or a team or not even, or sort of an idea?
So I have a rough framework that I built. I would just call it half-baked. So I'm not like ready to talk about it publicly, but it's nothing that you haven't heard of before. It's all the stuff around product market fit and prioritization and KPIs, but it's the practices of those things. And I'm not 100% sure. So like I said, I'm spending a lot of time thinking about it. So one of the things I'm doing is trying the framework in different markets, different size companies. So I've got like a pre-seed idea stage cohort. I've got sort of like a seed stage cohort. And these companies have raised a little bit of money, but not a ton, usually less than about $500,000. I have roughly a Series A level, and these companies have raised somewhere between like, call it $1 million to 4 or 5, maybe. I think the biggest ones raised 5. And then I've got a Series B cohort. And so these companies are sort of 10 plus raise roughly. These are very rough numbers. And so I'm testing out the frameworks and I'm trying to test out what works and what doesn't. And it's not a true scientific experiment because I don't have a control group and all these things. So I'm just trying to like look for what generally works and what doesn't. One of these days when I am well funded by research capital, which I don't know how to do at this stage of my career, I can try to run control groups and all those things. But anyway, so I'm just testing it. It's really early and at different stages.
Yeah. Okay. You may have touched on this at the beginning, but as a previous startup founder yourself, like what are the two biggest mistakes you see that founders make today?
Probably believing that they have product market fit before they do is problem one. And then maybe related to that is raising capital before they're ready. There's a lot of stuff on the team side. Like a lot of it is their mindset, like the team that they bring around them, how they're working with their co-founder, what they think that they need to be good at, how they prioritize their time. There's a lot of stuff in there that I think companies make, but it kind of boils down to not having product market fit when you think you do.
Yeah. And because the thing is, you mentioned, you know, many companies, I just took note exactly of what you said, many companies should not be raising. And I've seen it also like a few times actually where they raised money, they managed to raise money and then they kind of burnt the money very quickly when they were just in love with their idea. And it's just so clear. You can just try to see if it works very cheaply without spending all this. But just going back to what you were saying, like this is the hype around it. You should go and raise money. You should go and do it. And it's not always the case. When you're doing hardware, right, with tech, how can the companies start?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I mean, there are clearly lots of exceptions to the like raising money rule.
Mm-hmm.
And like biotech is a great example. In fact, I'm one of the companies that I'm working with. Their whole model is they will raise $150 million out of a dollar of revenue because the whole goal there is to be bought by big pharma, right? Pfizer, things like that. And so for them, it either works or doesn't work. And they have to raise money because it's all science. And they've got doctors and labs and test tubes and looking under microscopes and things. Okay, so those guys need to raise money. So hardware is a little bit different. I think if it's sure hardware doesn't have a software component, yeah, you need to raise capital. And if you can get away with a very ugly basic prototype or three, and sometimes there are ways of not having to raise capital, like customer funded fundraise, right? Like if you can get people to pre-order, if it's a B2B thing, you can sometimes get a company to a pilot and you can use that money. There are ways of doing it and it doesn't always work in every situation. But I would say try to raise as little as humanly possible to prove out that the hardware, people want it, that it will work. In theory, you should know if it works. Like you should know if it works before you build it. And that doesn't take a lot of money. But if it's hardware combined with software, I think sometimes the magic is usually in the software. It's not in hardware. The hardware is like powering, right? And so you can, a lot of times you can kind of fake that. You can fake that with ugly, bad prototypes that you hack together in your basement or whatever. You can use competitors' products and hack them together because a lot of times the magic is in software. And so you can build the software oftentimes without having to spend all this money on the hardware first. But there's no like silver bullet here. Each situation is different and you have to evaluate each one. I just want to make sure that founders are cautioned that silver bullet isn't fundraising. That's not always the answer. Explore every option before you explore the fundraising option. And there are times that fundraising is absolutely appropriate. I'm not saying don't fundraise ever. I'm saying you have to be smart about when you fundraise and make sure that it's the appropriate time that is this.
You work with tech stars and you're launching your own thing. What's your take on like founders who come out of programs and those who don't? Do you have any story to share or anything?
You mean as an investor?
Your personal program was with your dad, right? And you have your likes of tech stars and so on. What's your view?
Look, as part of Techstars, I drank the Kool-Aid. Like, I believe that those types of programs can be very, very powerful for founders. And the reason is because you get immersed in like-minded people. You get exposed to concepts and ways of thinking that maybe you didn't have before, right? You can learn so much and expand your own knowledge base and also expand your own network. I think the challenge comes when they do lots of programs, right? And so I always worry about the company that's done like 4 accelerator programs, 3 accelerator programs, 5 accelerator programs. Like really? Like you haven't accelerated. Like what are you doing? And so I do think that they're really powerful and I love them. I also want to caution founders is like if you're looking to external validation, like an accelerator program to really help you, you haven't yet built up the internal strength from yourself or from your team to execute on business. And so, okay, there are some exceptions to that. Like I went to a general accelerator and then I found this one that was specific to my industry or specific to the customer base that I need to go through. Okay, I get that one because you did one for general information and knowledge. And the second one is for network. And okay, it makes sense. But like 3 and 4 in.
Yeah, it becomes too much. I mean, even in one program, you get lots of mentorship and feedback, like different directions, different things.
The other thing I would caution is just in any program, you really want to look at who you're getting feedback from.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the challenges with the programs and being a founder in a program, right? Is you always need people that have actually experienced the challenge that you are facing. And you need more than one person that experienced it. So a lot of times, like, I would caution founders that are in programs where they're working with a lot of just more, like I would just say more junior people, right? Like if you're working with a VP of marketing, that's giving feedback to a CEO, an early stage CEO. Sorry, that VP of marketing might be very knowledgeable about marketing in their specific sector and at their specific stage of company. But that VP of marketing is not going to give good feedback to the CEO regarding business as a whole. Or if you're CEO of a publicly traded company, you're not going to give good feedback to a startup founder either because your resources are different. You're like, what do you mean you do that? And the startup founder is like, what are you talking about? Me and one other founder, like, I can't do that. We don't have the staff. We don't have the capital. They just have a very different reality. And so you're looking for, I think, making sure that the program that you're with has great talent in its mentorship pool. Experienced people, CEOs, founders that have been there multiple times, that kind of experience. And then also really learning as a founder to tune your ears into learning what feedback to listen to and what feedback to not listen to. And that can be hard when you're scared or you're freaked out or you're intimidated, right?
Yeah.
That can be really hard to turn on that ear judgment, but learning how to do that is a critical skill.
I launched the Founder Institute in Milan a few years ago. And man, I was getting bombarded by emails, like everyone wanted to be a mentor. And I felt rude, but I wasn't rude. I just had to be very, very selective because I put my name to the thing, right? And I wanted to add value. And I had to be to find people who would support. And it's really tough because you can have great people, but just not. And I totally relate to what you're saying here because you see that everywhere. That's a pattern. And it's interesting that you're saying it even where you are, you know, in the US, that this is happening as well, because you usually have this cliche. And I want to make sure that or the listeners hear that you can have similar stories in different places.
It's true. And I mean, I think everywhere, like I think in the age of social media, anyone can be an expert by putting on a blog post or starting an Instagram account or whatever when they have no background in it. And the truth is the real experts out there, real geniuses out there, heads down. They don't actually want to work with you because they're busy. They want to focus on their craft. They don't want to focus on loading. They don't want to focus on network. They don't want to focus. But a lot of times those people will absolutely help you if asked one-on-one. And so I think the trick is, it's like really just, it's a founder. It's something that you, as a founder, you have to be really diligent about, is making sure that the people that you're talking to, that you're getting advice from, actually, I want to say that a different way. The people that you're talking to, that you're taking advice from, getting mm-hmm. the tiki, know what they're talking about, because they've actually lived it firsthand and they've had both positive and negative experiences with it. So they can talk both sides, right?
Yeah.
Rather than somebody that's just been hanging out in the industry and has been around it a lot. Also, people that are responsible, have been accountable and responsible for those decisions, rather than people that have just been associated with those decisions. And so as a founder, that can be hard to do, because again, your time is limited. And sometimes, let's be honest, you're a little freaked out. You're not sure what to do. You're under a lot of stress. This is a big problem. You just need to solve it. You just want somebody to tell you what to do, and you start listening to anybody. So then you go ask ChatGPT, which is like the most terrible possible place to ask, right? ChatGPT aggregates all the answers across the web, which gives you a mediocre answer. And if you're going to create a great business, mediocre answers will not get you there. So neither will mediocre guidance.
So from an investor's point of view, what do you expect from an email from a founder? What do you look at first?
You mean
I guess, an email to...
A cold email, like first time somebody...
A cold email, yeah.
Yeah, this is a hard one, right? I respond to all of them and I always say no.
Okay.
And I always feel a little guilty when I say no, because I know, being a founder, how difficult it is to break into a network of people, especially if you don't have a network that's introducing you. The challenge is that I get that email a lot and I have no way of filtering against those people. And as I said earlier, I'm a people investor. I am not a business investor. Like, I invest early with people that I want to work with, that I believe that can get there. And I would have to meet with every single founder multiple times. So for me, those emails, I say thanks, but no thanks. And I always feel guilty when I do it, because I know that they're just trying to break in. So there's pretty much nothing that they're going to say in a first cold email to me that's going to get me to sway from that. So what does work, and again, this is unfortunate, is a warm introduction from somebody that I know and trust, and I will often take the meeting. I wish it wasn't that way. It's tough, but it is.
It's tough even now. I mean, you're talking about yourself as Nicole, but you also have lots of VC funds that have the forms and they say, like, fill out the form, and then they never answer. Or maybe they ghost companies, or they send an automated reply and it's no. And if it's going to be no most of the time, or maybe all the time, why would they even say, just reach out? Because now it's even tougher, because everyone wants to start a startup. Everyone wants to raise money. How do you see the VC landscape changing? Is it changing? I mean, it is changing. Well, but what do you see changing in your case? Because you also raise funds, right?
I mean, I think it's going to get harder, actually, before it gets better. So at least in the States, the run-up in valuations is leading to real loss, right? Yeah. So valuations have come down and the large asset allocators are not writing the same checks that they were writing to the VC landscape. And so we will see a lot of firms go out of business. And I can think of four firms that I know of that I'm friendly with that have decided to not raise another fund. And so we will see the number of VC firms go down. So that makes it even harder for founders, because there are just fewer firms to email, which means that those same firms are way more inbound than they were before. Now, what's the answer to that? I don't know. I mean, in some ways, an accelerator program, it's great because it is a stamp of approval that the VC funds use as a filter. Right? If you don't have that, it's harder. I think there are ways of doing it. I think you just have to be really clever and creative about it. And I wrote a story about this once on my blog post. But like, I had a founder that like he had been wanting to get a meeting with me for a really long time. It was bugging me. And I was like, no. And he did two things that really stood out. So first of all, he took out a Facebook ad on my profile alone. It was not a message. It was an ad, like, in my Facebook feed. I don't even know. I mean, I'm not an advertising expert, so I know, I guess there are ways of doing that. Maybe there aren't anymore.
Yeah.
So, but like, with literally an ad on the side, and it was like, hey, Nicole, and it was him. And I was sort of mind blown that he figured out how to do that and did it just to get a meeting with me. And then the second thing he did was fill my office with balloons completely. Like it was like to the ceiling. I mean,
I saw the picture. Yeah.
It was bananas. Okay. Yeah. He got a meeting.
Well, you had to. You had no choice.
And he eventually got into Techstars and funded him. And that, for what it's worth, he then ended up working for me because his company didn't work.
Okay.
And he ended up working for me for a number of years. So I think the founder's job becomes, I said this a little bit in venture deals, it's not a transaction. It's a relationship. And so when you can start the relationship early and build the relationship, then when it comes time for the transaction, it becomes much easier because you're not doing these cold outreaches. Work in some cases, but for many of us, they don't, right?
Yeah.
And so working on the relationship. And for every, and here's where it gets hard, right? For every person, that's going to be a little different. And if you're in an area that you, is a really hard area to build relationships because you're in some rural area or you're in an area where the investors aren't really, like you have to figure out how to do it digitally or virtually. And that can be tricky. But it starts with like just following them on their social profiles and commenting on their posts and just paying attention. But this is why I always hesitate to say this because I'm like, that is a lot of energy that you're spending. Mm-hmm. Can you just spending that energy driving revenue? Like if you spent that same amount of energy driving revenue, you might never need the investor. Or at least when you do, you've got a way different story. You're like, I'm growing at 70% year over year and I have for the last 3 years and I don't need your money.
What do
I
do? And then come after you. Yeah.
And after you. As the associates that are out there that are beating the street, that's what they do.
So like today you have investors who want revenue over just the vision, or they want revenue versus traction. Are we going to see more and more of this because of the crazy valuations that happened over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I think so. For a while, probably for the next, if I had to guess, 2 to 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll start to swing back to like, it's your idea and they will invest in the idea. And there are seed funds out there. There are pre-seed funds out there that absolutely will invest in those early stages. Hopefully they stay alive.
Yeah, that's the, I mean, a number of companies are not raising their third fund or whatever. And I heard of a few in London. I have one more question here. I'm asking this question on this fourth season, depending on who I'm talking to, but do you think we're in an AI bubble? What's your take on this now?
Oh, we're definitely defined AI bubble. What do you mean by that?
Well, so key steer again. So I had like Bernard Moon kind of said, yes, like we are, but he's not like one who's jumping just because of AI and all the buzzwords, you know. But Keith Thier said, like, for him, a bubble is an opportunity. And AI is an opportunity. That's how he sees it. I want to see, what are you seeing today? Because you're cross, right? So you're not focusing on one vertical or anything. So
if you define bubble as opportunity, then hell yeah, right? I do think there's a big opportunity in AI. I don't know that I believe that the average startup is going to capture any of that opportunity. I think the best minds in the world are already working on it in very large, you know, OpenAI, the big companies. I think it was maybe very, very hard for startup to unseat or do something different because they already have, those big companies already have the best talent. Now, that doesn't mean it can't happen, but it just means that the likelihood of it, that luck thing, is a lot lower, right? I mean, some of the stuff that I see that's coming out in AI, I'm like kind of eye rolling about. Really? When I think about all the things that AI could really help me do, no one's actually tackling them because they're the really hard, they're hard problems, right? But like, I mean, even to go after art as a first attempt, I mean, come on, seriously? There are so many other things that we could be doing with AI to like create art from words. Like that's such a niche thing. And by the way, the artists that are out there, we really don't unseat artists.
Well, you didn't want hairdressers.
Like, they still cut my hair. They just don't dye it.
True.
But hey, how about my tax return? How about lunch? I mean, we all know that it's coming, it's going there anyway, but like those ones haven't come out there yet because it's hard. Yeah. And so like, your AI that is going to add a 2% efficiency to my calendaring, but then it messes something up and I don't even know why I messed something up and I don't get it. It's like not an order of magnitude better. It has to be an order of magnitude better, or it has to be super, super painful. So even the writing, like even the writing stuff that I see that comes out, I'm like, yeah, okay. Yeah, I wrote something and it's mediocre. It's mediocre. Maybe it will get amazing, but is it ever going to be Mark Twain or Hafiz? No. And the docs that you're using it to write are docs nobody wants to read. I worked with a founder for a while that was using it to write board updates.
Oh, and okay.
And I wasn't reading them because they were bad. And he would get frustrated, right? And I was like, if you can't take time to write me something that's interesting, why should I take time to read it? You didn't say anything in there that I didn't already know. And it's not adding value, basically. It's not adding value. But is there opportunity? Absolutely.
Okay. And my last question here is, do you trust your gut when you're going to make big decisions? Working with someone, investing in what's,
I watched this. So I have a professional crush on the guy that runs a podcast called The Knowledge Project. His name is Shane Parrish. And if you don't know him, am I allowed to do that? Is that bad?
No, please. That's an open platform. Spread knowledge and so on. So please go ahead.
Yeah. And he actually has a course on making decisions. And I've been studying decision science for probably 15 years because as an investor, that's really, it's all about the decisions that you make early and then supporting the outcomes of those decisions over the next decade, right?
And you have a post on that as well. So
yeah, I mean, it's like everything is on that initial decision. And one of the things that I learned to do early on in my career was really come back and review all my decisions all the time because every year it changes, right? So I can tell you every single portfolio company that I've ever invested in, and I keep like an annual score on it. Like, how's it doing? Like when I made the investment decision, I talk a lot about what I liked, what I didn't like, the risks that I thought were associated with it, you know, any hesitations that I had and why I was making the decision, like why I ended up saying yes. I just capture some basic information. And then every year I go back and I look at that and I'm like, how accurate was I? And over time, you get better and better. Your gut gets better and better at developing when you do things like that, right? And so do I trust my gut? At first, I did not. I trust my gut a lot more now, but I still record a lot. So that I can continue to refine and improve my gut. And I think that combo of actions of like listening to my gut, but also like writing down and articulating and trying to record and then revisiting is a thing that helps refine it. And I will tell you with really big decisions, I am very slow to decide. And once I have decided, I'm also very, very quick to act. So because of that, I tend to not make big investments. Like it's been a long time since I've like led around in a company or something like that. Because it takes me so long to decide that the company itself is like we can't wait for you. And it is evil to the company, right? They need to raise the money. And so that's why I'm saying like my own strategy is I want to spend a lot of time with the company. This doesn't quite fit the current model anymore. So that's why I'm working on this program that I'm working on. But yes, I do trust my gut, but I also record it so that I can, and I'm wrong a lot. But as long as I'm right more than 52% of the time, I win.
I like how this is coming all together because going back to the venture deals course, I looked at your strategic list creation where you were talking about research, prioritization, alignment, and like how you reach out to investors and how actually the visual of it was shared. And this is like sales, but sometimes it can click with anyone. It's like, you know, why am I not doing this right when company wants to start? And this is how you're doing, you do it for yourself. So this is coming all together. Yeah. So, no, thank you so much. I don't know if there's anything you want to add because I'm conscious of time.
Maybe just one thing, which is I think all investors, I mentioned this earlier, right? We can drink our own Kool-Aid and we start to believe ourselves sometimes. And I think the key to being a great investor, not just a good investor, is just continuous self-improvement. And for me, it means a lot of reading. So I read a lot. And I also try, you know, I have discipline around things like keeping a decision journal and things like this. But if you're a venture investor or even a private equity, one of the books that I would encourage you to read or reread if it's been a while is called The Most Important Thing. And it's basically designed for public market investors, but 100% of the principles apply to venture. And when you read it, you realize how opposite everybody in venture is acting and how necessary all of the information is. And so I would encourage all of us to focus on continuous self-improvement, focus on continuous curiosity, read, learn, grow, treat your companies with respect because they're people, right? And hopefully you'll be a great investor.
thank you for answering a question that I would have liked to ask, like, how do you keep learning? So that's a good message, and shout that to everyone out there. And for me, that's a way to grow and learn and share that with other people and having people like you here. So thank you so much.
Wow, thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
Thank you so much for listening. If you've derived value from the show, you can subscribe on platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Your feedback is incredibly important to us, so please consider rating the show or leaving a review. It's a fantastic way to help other podcast explorers discover our content. To gain more insights, visit our website at ggutt.com. This is wgutt.com, and see you next time.